It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The movie about Milwaukee's legendary Neil Diamond tribute band, Lightning and Thunder, is set to open Christmas Day in theaters.
It's called Song Sung Blue. It follows the real-life story of Claire and Mike Sardina from Wisconsin, who fell in love and found success on stage with Neil Diamond's music.
The two performed together from 1989 until Mike's death in 2006. They played venues like the Wisconsin State Fair and Summerfest, opening for Pearl Jam and performing with lead singer Eddie Vedder.
Based on a 2008 documentary of the same name, the film stars Kate Hudson alongside Hugh Jackman. Jackman calls the movie a love letter to Milwaukee.
Producer Beatrice Lawrence attended the Milwaukee premiere of the movie earlier this month. It drew together friends and family of Claire and Mike Sardina. Star Hugh Jackman was also there. Here's a listen.
The food, the people, just the feeling here today. We went to some schools. The feeling in this city, there's something special about it, and I sort of knew that because of doing this movie. And being here tonight is in many ways the most important night for this movie. Being here with the family, whose lives we're portraying. I don't know. I've absolutely loved it. The cold has surprised me a little bit. I may not have been fully prepared. I think it's a movie about all of us, no matter what. And it makes me, every time I see it, I walk out in the street and I want to know what's going on in everyone's life. Because there's no such thing as just normal, everyday lives. Every life is extraordinary.
The film's director, Craig Brewer, was at the Milwaukee premiere. Beatrice asked him about the first time he learned about Lightning and Thunder.
Well, kind of like all the stories that intrigue you, like, I thought it was just going to be fun. I saw it at a film festival, and I was like, oh, well, this is just going to be a fun little thing that I'm going to see, like, some band, you know, doing Neil Diamond songs. And then this story just, like, started unfolding, and I was just captivated with it. It was just incredible. It really was. When it comes to, like, stories about just, like, people that are, like, struggling, but they really also ultimately want to be artists, that's what really got me. It's like they wanted to just perform and also like be very committed to each other and committed to their community. And that's really the kind of movies that I've always really been, you know, inspired by.
Claire Sardina joins us now to talk about her memories of performing with her late husband, Mike, and how it feels to see her story told on the big screen. Claire, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This movie had a big premiere playing to a packed theater. It'll be in theaters nationwide opening on Christmas. How does it feel to see this deeply personal part of your life represented on the big screen?
Well, it's emotional. I'm elated. I am humbled. And I love the fact that the story is getting out and nationwide, not only nationwide, but worldwide, and being recognized by people such as Oprah Winfrey and Howard Stern and Reba McEntire, things like that, yes.
What do you think, Mike, would make of this moment and the crowds coming to see a movie about your story?
I think he, too, would be elated, and I believe in my heart of hearts that he is. He watches over me. He guides me. I look up to the heavens when I feel somewhat overwhelmed by all the hype, and he brings me back to the level of the performer that he taught me to be. So he himself would have been It would have been a dream for him, and it is a dream come true.
You say that he taught you to be a performer. What skills did he pass on to you that you keep with you today?
Just the overall entertainer in him. He showed me how to be a true entertainer, number one, you know, to not be fazed by things that were happening outside, but feel the stage in 100% every aspect and be there for the people. He taught me that because he was such a people person himself. And entertainers, in my opinion, should be that way anyway. They shouldn't be performing for themselves. They should be performing for their audiences, whether they're big or small. So he taught me those things. He taught me vocal skills, how to sing, like, just by listening to him, not necessarily taught me. And, you know, we did, sometimes we were cute and did vocal exercises prior to, but both of us practice our craft as far as our tributes were concerned. And again, he was an interpreter of the great Neil Diamond. He didn't call himself an impersonator, which was good. It was great because he wanted to do the music of the great Neil Diamond for people to love and enjoy. And what I've heard is that, you know, I heard Hugh Jackman say on one of his interviews, we believe that if it wasn't for Mike, this whole thing wouldn't be happening because Mike was a dreamer. And we feel the music, the movie has really, because of Mike, this is why this movie is taking place. And I agree with that. I mean, I was his counterpart, the love of his life. And again, he was a teacher to me, a father to my children, so many things. He would be thrilled.
I'm wondering, out of all the legendary musicians who are out there to be singing tribute to, why Neil Diamond? Why did the two of you channel Neil Diamond?
Well, we got advice from an Elvis impersonator at the time, and he stopped Lightning and said, and Lightning had dabbled a little bit with a couple of Neil Diamond songs, and he stopped him and said, you know what? This is something you need to pursue. And Lightning listened to him, and then he got the hairstyle, you know, he's got the dark hair, and he took on kind of the persona of Neil, but his own persona too, because again, his claim to fame was, I am not a Neil Diamond impersonator. I am an interpreter of the music of the great Neil Diamond. It's my honor and pleasure to sing the music of the great Neil Diamond. And he learned many, many of the classics and all the popular Neil Diamond songs and put it together in about a 45 to 50 minute set of a tribute that attracted audiences everywhere.
You took on Patsy Cline, who was such a trailblazer for women at the time, you know, really pioneering a way for women to be lead singers. And she never fully realized her country music stardom, you know, dying tragically, an early death in a plane crash.
Right.
What did you see in Patsy Cline as an artist?
Well, what I saw was, I loved her country twang. I loved her, you know, I loved her stage presence with the videos that I watched. And I loved the meaning of her songs. The meaning of her songs, you know. I fall to pieces. And of course, her all-time favorite hit of classic hit Crazy. And Sweet Dreams is featured in the movie Song Sung Blue. I love that song. Walking After Midnight. I mean, her songs had strive and meaning to them. And the audiences just ate it up. And they would sing along with me. And I attracted a large senior audience, because the seniors, when they were younger, they experienced the late, great Patsy Cline before she perished in the plane crash.
Claire Sardina is with us talking about the memories from her legendary Neil Diamond tribute band, Lightning and Thunder. She shared the stage with her late husband, Mike Sardina, and their life is the subject of a new film called Song Sung Blue. Claire, at the height of your popularity in Milwaukee, you were in an accident. The car hits you while you're outside your home. You end up losing your foot.
Right.
How did that affect you and Mike as musicians and as a couple?
Well, I was, to be exact, gardening in my front yard. A car came up on my property and ran me over and took my leg. And of course, the impact was strong, as it would be to any other family and circumstance. You know, no matter what their circumstance is, it rocked our world. And for a while, we thought we weren't going to be able to get up and go again. You know, my feelings of insecurity, my mental health went downhill. The pharmaceuticals that they put me on because of my operations were strong, and I had had several operations. And Lightning was alive during all but one of my operations that I had. So it impacted the whole family. But yes, it put a monkey wrench, as I quote from the movie, in all aspects of our life, even the performance aspect. So it took a while to get back on our feet, no pun.
I wonder how singing affected your recovery and your ability to heal.
Oh, well, that's easy. Music is a universal healing power to it. Music, singing. I've got a God-given gift that I like to share with people. Ever since I was 3 years old, I was singing. I wasn't going to let this hold me back. It took me a while to bounce back after the loss of Lightning, which happened after the accident, of course, you know, in concession. So I had time where I hermitized myself, reflected, looked into myself. I ended up quit smoking. I had a major operation that I was actually in a wheelchair for 9 months, but it pivoted me to now being able to dance and sing. And I still, of course, do perform.
What can we learn from your life story, even if we're not musicians who go on stage?
What you can learn is attitude is everything. You know, there's the way, the truth and the light of everything that is real. Now, I mean, I'd say to people across the board, if you look at others that are less fortunate than you are, put yourself in their position and you won't feel so sorry for yourself. Because others, there are others out there that have far greater disabilities or just life problems or cancer victims for that matter. Everybody's got a health story to tell. And it's all in the attitude. And this too shall pass, as Lightning would say. That was one of his favorites. I think it comes from AA as an expression. And that's what I would tell people to do. Be positive, and this too shall pass. You can do this. You can do this. You just don't sit in the chair and feel sorry for yourself and wither and waste away. Get up, do something, do your stretches, do your rehab, listen to your doctors, have surgery, have what it takes to become a whole person again, and pray. I pray a lot, too.
Claire, thank you for sharing your story and your inspirational words. Appreciate it.
Yes, no problem.
That is Claire Sardina. She shared the stage with her late husband, Mike Sardina, as Lightning and Thunder, a Neil Diamond tribute band that performed around Milwaukee from 1989 until 2006. Their life is the subject of a new film starring Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson called Song Sung Blue. It comes out this week. This is Lightning and Thunder performing Neil Diamond's Forever in Blue Jeans with Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder at Summerfest in 1995. Coming up, Among American Chef from Wisconsin is getting national recognition for a restaurant in the Twin Cities. She tells us how her days on a Wisconsin farm prepared her for success.
Being able to move two worlds together was really refreshing to realize that, hey, I've been doing this my whole life. I just didn't realize it.
That's next from WPR News.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend.
Food and Wine Magazine's 2025 Restaurant of the Year is a small Hmong American restaurant in the Twin Cities. It's called Diane's Place.
And the chef behind it all, Diane Mua, grew up on a farm in Junction City in central Wisconsin.
Each week as a kid, Diane and her family would get up early in the morning and travel 2 hours south to Madison to sell their produce at the big Dane County Farmers Market.
The environment that she grew up in, the food, the culture, and the hospitality, it all inspired the vision for her restaurant.
Three-time James Beard Award finalist Diane Mua joins us now to talk about how her time in Wisconsin shaped her food journey and the possibility of someday bringing her talents back to our state. Diane, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to where your journey with food began. You grew up on a farm, I understand, near Junction City in central Wisconsin. What are some of your earliest food memories there with the farm and your family?
You know, we ate a lot during the summer. We ate a lot of fresh veggies, not a lot of protein. I mean, protein, if we did, is from the farm, but, you know, lots of veggies from the farm. Lots of, you know, even when my dad was growing ginseng, it was like, oh, let's boil chicken with some ginseng. Anything that grew, we ate. You know, I'm being introduced to beet, red beets. We didn't grow up eating beets, but my parents were selling at the farmer's market. So there was a point in our life where we would just eat beets. So lots of veggies.
And you worked with your family selling produce at the Dane County Farmer's Market, a familiar institution to a lot of people listening. What are your memories from that really big farmer's market?
Oh, man. I hated the drive. I didn't love the drive there because it was so early.
Right.
It was a 2-hour drive for us, so we would have to get up really early. The drive there wasn't my favorite, but I love the farmer's market. It was like we would quickly try to set up so that we can go around and see what everyone else had. Even if it was just to buy coffee or pastries, it was very exciting to see what everybody else had to bring to the day. And, you know, a lot of the best parts was, you know, that at the end of the day when all the farmers talk and it's like, hey, can I give you some cabbage for some corn, you know? And it was just a lot of love, you know, a lot of love. And everybody knew it was hard work, but it was a beautiful farmer's market.
And I think you described your family home as kind of a hub for your local Hmong community. How did your family create that that environment?
You know, in Stevens Point, the Hmong community there is pretty big. So my dad is a pretty well leader in the Hmong community. So, you know, when we're not at the farmer's market, we're on the weekends. My parents are either at somebody's house or they're at our house. Family is huge in the Hmong community. So we're always in groups.
And your parents, like many Hmong people in Wisconsin, settled in the Midwest after fleeing the Vietnam War, the wider war in Southeast Asia. What kind of things did they pass on to you from that experience? What kind of things did they maybe, protect you from?
You know, they tried to protect us. I mean, I remember growing up. So when my parents came to the U.S., they landed in Providence, Rhode Island. That was where our grandpa was. And we stayed together as a pack. So we ended up in Rhode Island. They worked really hard. My dad said within a month, they were both able to get a job. My mom was going to school. But the hard work, I really think that seeing my parents, how hard they worked, that it's instilled in me, you know, being able to be where I am now is because of my parents pushing me. When we were younger, my dad always said, you guys go to school, speak English. When you guys come home, you guys have to speak Hmong. And they're new to parenting. They're new to the U.S. But to me, I still feel like I'm, you know, I'm 43, and sometimes I feel like my English isn't good enough, nor is my Hmong good enough. So I'm like always in the middle where it's like Hmonglish. So they try to like make sure they're preserving the language, but at the same time, it was really hard for us because when you go to school, you speak English, when you come home, it's Hmong. But we learned really quickly that wasn't really sustainable, you know, because it was really holding me back in school too because of the language barrier.
Now, when did you first start thinking you like cooking and, hey, this is a career for me?
Well, I always, when you go to any Hmong gathering, all the ladies are always in the kitchen. They're all helping each other cook. It was always fun to me. I love that part. I love meeting. I love having, like, you know, like I was just telling my boyfriend, I can't wait to get a house so we can start having house parties and house dinners. That was the best part of it. You go to somebody's house or they come to your house and everybody's in the kitchen, you're cooking, somebody learn a new dish. That was a really good part of like growing up and seeing that. And I still love doing all of that. So that, I feel like, you know, having the restaurant was really easy too, because I can relate to the two. You know, I always tell people, come to the restaurant. This is, you know, come in, let's take care of you. It's the same way of like when people come to our house.
What was your path from, you know, liking cooking in this community through working, I think, at a lot of different restaurants to opening your own restaurant? What was that trajectory like?
It was really hard. You know, I feel like the last maybe 6-7 years was when I was like, wow, this is my world clashing together. Growing up, my parents always had people over, and whenever they come visit, it wasn't just, hi, how are you doing? It was like, come in, let's have dinner. I didn't really realize about the hospitality of that. It was just the same as a restaurant. You know, I've been in the restaurant industry for 20 plus years. And there was a point I'm like, wow, I do this for a living. You know, when we go to Hmong houses, we cook in masses. When you have a restaurant, you're cooking for, you know, 120, 200 people for dinner. So the two really relates to each other. And being able to move two worlds together was really refreshing. To realize that, hey, I've been doing this my whole life. I just didn't realize it.
And you, in your restaurant career before Diane's Place, you didn't necessarily gravitate toward, hey, I'm going to cook Hmong food in particular. What kind of things did you seek out and get trained in?
I did pastry. So I was a pastry chef. I did plated desserts. Then I opened up a bakery with Gavin Kaysen. Then I did fine dining. It was a mash of everything, but I was very fortunate. I worked with a lot of amazing chefs. I was always curious when I worked at this Spanish tapas restaurant, Solera. As a pastry assistant, pastry chef, you always get cut. Meaning if the restaurant's slow, the pastry department is the first to go, right? So I really make sure that I learned how to work the savory line. I worked how to do the salad station. So I figured out that part early on in my career was I have to learn sweet and savory. And all the chefs I worked throughout my career, I learned a little bit here and there from all of them. I was able to bring that a lot to the restaurant now.
We're talking to Diane Mua, executive chef and owner of Diane's Place in the Twin Cities. Diane, originally from central Wisconsin. All right, Diane's Place now, it's your name's right there. What was your vision when you were opening this restaurant?
The vision was basically to give back to the Hmong community, give back to my parents. I named it Diane's Place because I was the first child born in the U.S. and the people that sponsored us named me. So it's kind of going back to my roots. Being able to open the restaurant, we started brunch first because I was a pastry chef for 20 plus years. So, you know, I wanted to really showcase the pastry, really showcase brunch. You know, we were really busy when we opened. And then, you know, it took us almost 6-7 months until we opened dinner. And it was a really highly anticipated restaurant opening. So lots of stress there. But the, you know, I always just wanted like a neighborhood restaurant, and what turns out a neighborhood restaurant that has been doing really good. So I'm really proud of the restaurant. I'm really proud of my team. But you know, you don't open a restaurant to say, yeah, I'm going to win all these awards or get all these accolades. You open it because you just want to do the best that you can. For me, I wanted to open a really good restaurant where I can showcase my pastry, where I can showcase my Hmong heritage. And I was able to do that.
Right. You mentioned the pastries. What kind of Hmong dishes or Hmong influenced dishes are in the restaurant, especially when you, as you said, branched out into dinner?
You know, we do dinner. I feel like we have more traditional dishes on brunch. You have your regular, you know, like we have our Asian chicken noodle soup. We have our bean thread noodle, which is one of the first noodles. I remember when growing up, any house you went to, they made this bean thread noodle because it was really simple and easy to make. But I feel like all the grandmas and aunties are so advanced now with YouTube and making noodles. So every time you go, they have like a different high-end pad thai or something else. But this bean thread noodle is one of the very first noodles that I remember the Hmong ladies cooked when we went to anybody's house. So that's on the menu. Dinner, we have like our Asian pulled pork, which is a very traditional Hmong dish. We have our steamed pork rolls. We have a duck stew that is normally made with game meat. So it's usually with deer or squirrel, but at the restaurant, we make it with duck.
Are there Hmong dishes that, you know, for people who are not Hmong or who are Hmong but haven't cooked a lot, are there good gateway recipes or dishes you recommend people get started with when they want to start exploring Hmong cooking at home?
Yeah, you know, I guess one of the most simple dish I have is, you know, if you take some pork, can be pork shoulder, you just chop it up in little cubes. You get some water going, you throw a little lemongrass in there, throw your pork in it, cook until it's cooked. And then you take mustard green, which you can get at any Asian store. You get mustard green, you wash it. Make sure your pork is cooked. You take the greens, cut it up, you know, bite size. Throw it in this pot, salt, pepper. That's like a very traditional light pork and mustard green stew.
I always love asking chefs, because the answers, there's such a wide variety of answers. When you're cooking for yourself, you're on your own time, what kind of things do you tend to gravitate toward?
Oh, my God. I love, you know, I just came back from an early Thanksgiving from my brother's house in Madison, and my sister-in-law made a dish of pork and mustard greens. That the greens were from my parents' farm, and to me, I mean, we had turkey, we had egg rolls, we had everything, but to me, that was me. It's like, it's very homey. It's very comforting. And I think I ate like 5 bowls of that. So it's either pork or chicken. I just love, like, you know, Hmong cooking is very, very simple. And so to me, if I'm on my day, if I have a day off, I'm eating either a poached chicken with just low lemongrass, salt, pepper, or my traditional pork with mustard green.
You know, I've also interviewed in the past Ya Vang, who grew up just a little to the south of you, I think, and went on to restaurant success. Mm-hmm. In the Twin Cities, what would it take to get some of our central Wisconsin-born great Hmong chefs to open restaurants on this side of the Wisconsin-Minnesota border?
You know, I think it will happen. It might happen soon. I always joke that if I was to ever open a next spot, it would be in Madison, Wisconsin, you know, because I think that city is so amazing. But I think maybe once we're less busy, we can consider it. But Wisconsin is not out of the picture for me.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned you didn't open a restaurant to win awards. When you do get that kind of recognition, national recognition in some cases, what does that mean for you as a restaurant owner and a chef?
It means so much. I mean, it means so much to me, the community, my team. I wouldn't be here if my team, everyone's like, you know, I always tell my team, it's not just about the food. It's about the experience. So when people come to eat, yes, if the food is not great, but they had a good service, likely they might come back, or vice versa. If the food is really good, the service might not be good, but they might still come back. But imagine if the food is good and the service is good, you know? So that's what we strive to do and what we strive for. And I hope we keep doing it. But just to put like a small Hmong restaurant on a national level, it's pretty amazing.
Speaking of the team there, I'm a guy, I love to cook at home. I think I would just instantly fold under the pressure of working in a restaurant kitchen. How in what I imagine can be a high pressure environment of, you know, being performing at a high level each and every day. How do you keep a good team atmosphere going at your restaurant?
You know, support, making sure that they feel supported. You know, if you ever see me at the restaurant, I'm not just in the back kitchen. I'm on the floor helping clear greeting guests. I think it's very important as a leader that you have to lead by example. Like I always say, I don't have my staff doing anything that I don't want to do. If I'm not going to clean, if it is beneath me to clean, sweep, or mop, why should I expect them to do the same? So I really lead by example. And I hope, I don't know, this is my first time running a restaurant, but every restaurant I've worked at, I was really proud to work at the places where I've had, and I hope I can create this restaurant where people are proud to work at. And so far, we're doing really good.
If there's somebody in Wisconsin listening now, a young person who grew up with food, loved cooking, is thinking, hey, maybe I want to pursue this dream of a restaurant, what would be your advice to them to pursue that path?
I would say find a restaurant that you really like, call them up, and just say, hey, I really think I like cooking. I cook a lot at home. Is there any way I can hang out with you guys one day just to see how you do things? You know, I always say we call it in the restaurant industry a stage. But coming for a stage, you know, it could be a few hours. Back in the day, it used to be 8 hours, but it's totally up to you. But when we bring people in a stage, it's usually an hour or two. And basically, it's a test run to see if this is something you really want to do before you invest in the money to go to culinary school.
Diane, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Diane Mua is executive chef and owner of Diane's Place, an award-winning Hmong American restaurant in Minneapolis. She joined us to talk about her journey from a Wisconsin farm to big city restaurateur. Meet 14-year-old Aiden Levy, a Beatles superfan who hosts a new monthly show on Sirius XM, The Beatles Channel, with assistance from text-to-speech technology.
I am a non-speaker with autism and apraxia, so the Beatles really connect with me. I find their music so inspiring and hopeful, and I am trying to be the same.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're with us on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Shorewood family's Christmas adventure.
Every holiday season has its twinkles of drama. For journalist Dan Simmons, his unforgettable moment involves the family Christmas tree. He shares his fiasco with us just before the holidays.
Every Black Friday, we head out to a farm in the Milwaukee exurbs, park in a gravel lot, and pay $125 in exchange for a saw and a shopping trip. We go to the woods, and I cut down a tree that my wife approves. The height must be right, and the branches must be symmetrical, and the needles must pledge not to start dropping until New Year's. Sometimes we name our new addition, Bruce the Spruce, or Fraser Crane, for example. Teenagers in Carhartt jackets and Santa hats, loaded on top of the family roadster, and off we go. In one of the early years, our daughter seemed to obsess about the tree. About 500 times on the ride home, Frankie repeated this line, "Da twee is still on, da woof." The next year, we went to two farms before meeting just the right tree. Frankie actually picked it out and later explained that it was the perfect tree. It was tall and chubby. As we were about to turn the Honda Fit onto Port Washington, the road next to Interstate 43, the thought occurred to me, why not just take the highway? Mary replied, "Are you sure the tree will stay on if we're going that fast?" We just merged into highway traffic when our tree appeared in the rearview mirror. It was shooting backwards at significant velocity, trailing a blizzard of needles. It landed in the middle lane of southbound 43. Da Twi was not on to Woof, it was on to Woad. Cars were coming at it 70 miles per hour. I pulled our car to the shoulder, dialed 911, and prayed. We watched in the rearview mirror. One car after the other approached, saw Da Twi, and panicked. I am an enormous NBA basketball fan. There's a move called the Eurostep. It involves driving toward the basket at full speed, planting your foot, and somehow darting to the side to avoid a defender. I watched an orange Subaru pull off a Giannis-esque Eurostep around the tree, swerving right just before impact, going 75 miles per hour. Car after car somehow found a way to avoid contact until, that is, the 18-wheel semi came trucking at it. There was no sudden stopping, no Euro-stepping around it. The truck plowed straight into the tree. Merry freaking Christmas. This guy was just doing his job, and through zero fault of his own, he was pushing pine. The balsam rode that chrome front grille like a snowplow. The truck didn't slow down. The tree didn't let go. Sparks were flying. Needles were dancing. This was cinema. But how would it end? A quarter mile past impact, the big rig pulled over to the shoulder. The driver got out. He pulled our tall and chubby tree from under his truck, chucked it in the ditch, climbed back into the cab, and kept on trucking. I called the tree farm. We heard the gruff-sounding voice on the other end yelling at the kids in the Santa hats. My daughter, stoic throughout this situation, burst into tears. It hurt her to hear the boys getting reamed. It wasn't their fault. We decided that we would get another tree. I agreed to rent a U-Haul. I drove that orange-accented moving truck of shame into the gravel lot. The guys in Santa hats profusely apologized. We profusely apologized back. We found a great new tree, named it Trina Turner. Mary and the girls turned Trina into the most dazzling, tasteful version of herself. I hoisted Frankie to top it with the same glittery star we use every year. It's another example of how Christmas is always better when it actually happens, once the preparations and adventures that led up to it are in the rear view. There's also wisdom in a Jewish friend's reaction. Ah, the ways of you Gentiles.
Dan Simmons is a journalist who lives in Shorewood. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Piet Levy has been a music writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for over a dozen years. Recently, he wrote a music story unlike anything he's ever published. Here he is.
There's no greater joy in my life than being a father to my 14-year-old son, Aiden, and my 12-year-old twin daughters, Ava and Mia. Watching them grow and explore their passions brings me immense pride. For Aiden, one of those passions is the Beatles, and learning to tell me about it was a milestone in his communication.
Aiden is a non-speaker with autism and apraxia. When he was six, he started communicating by spelling out thoughts on a letter board one letter at a time.
Aiden is also a huge Beatles fan. He co-hosts a new monthly show on Sirius XM, The Beatles Channel. Alongside a fellow non-speaker, Aiden shares songs and commentary through text-to-speech technology.
I talked with his dad, Piet Levy, about his son's journey and their bond over music. Piet used that technology so Aiden could answer my questions and choose his own voice. I start by asking Piet to describe his son.
Aiden's incredible. He's one of the most positive people that I know. He can be very silly, especially with his sisters, Ava and Mia. They're both their identical twin sisters, both 12. Be very, very goofy with them. They are big fans of the movie Twilight, and Aiden really dislikes the movie Twilight, much to their chagrin, and will kind of mock them about that. So there's a lot of teasing that goes on there. He's an extremely passionate and driven person. He's really passionate about raising awareness around, as a non-speaker with autism and apraxia, raising awareness and understanding for people like him, for others, and trying to ensure people like him are better understood, make people recognize that they, you know, people like him are very smart. They have a lot of feelings. They have a lot to share and a lot to contribute, and that they get an appropriate education and that they get access to communication. It can be very challenging to communicate, but Aiden is very, very passionate and very determined about that. And he loves things like the Beatles. He's obsessed with the Beatles, really loves the Lord of the Rings books, very into Stranger Things right now, loves Marvel movies, and doing a lot of really fun adventures all the time.
Just like you would expect from a 14-year-old. Aiden is a non-speaker. How have you helped him find his authentic voice?
Yeah, so Aiden is a non-speaker with autism and apraxia. And, you know, to clarify, in terms of you know, apraxia, it's a neurological condition that will affect a person's ability to plan movements, to coordinate movements. So for Aiden, for instance, it might be hard for him to smile on cue for a picture when he's doing a picture with the family or whatever it might be. Very hard to master fine motor skills. And that would include like typing on a computer, on a keyboard, writing with a pen. That's very, very difficult. And with his apraxia and autism, he, you know, he knows what he wants to say, but he physically cannot speak. So Aiden wasn't speaking. And at 2.5, my wife, Aiden's mom, Christy, she really wanted to check and see if we should take him to a developmental pediatrician to be evaluated. And Aiden was diagnosed with autism. And it was a very confusing time because we, you know, autism is a very broad diagnosis. Mm-hmm. We weren't really sure what the next steps were going to be to help him. We just knew that we really wanted to help him, you know, help him communicate in some way. And so we tried different things. He worked with a traditional speech therapist, but the words never really came out. And he had a communication app and an iPad in school. But with apraxia too, there could be like impulsive movements. So he would impulsively tap buttons, but it wasn't really meaningful communication, I guess you could say. So we were just trying to find ways for him to communicate. And we found a path for him by spelling on a letter board. It's a board with letters on it. And you can spell, it's less demanding than fine motor skills like typing on a keyboard or writing with a pen because it involves gross motor skills. Mm-hmm. It still takes great, great practice, great stamina, great coordination, great, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. But starting at 6, after we found out about this, Aiden did try it. And he did make some progress in those first sessions like we'd never really seen before in terms of communication. It really did feel for us like, okay, this is going to be the path. And that was, you know, he's 14 now. That was 6. There's been daily practice throughout that. And very slowly over all those years, his ability to, you know, how he's able to communicate, it expanded greatly from, you know, writing short sentences, like simple kind of poems and stories, to like very complicated poems and stories and thoughts and elaborate things and commentary for a radio show and deep feelings. And so, but it's just taken a lot of work for Aiden, a lot of work with us to really get to the point that he is at now.
And using a letterboard and text-to-speech technology, you were able to ask my questions to Aiden for this interview. And thank you so much for including him here with us. And the first thing I wanted to find out was how Aiden became a Beatles super fan. And I want to listen to how he tells it.
Hi, Kate. I'm so honored to be on your show today. We are always playing music in our family. And the Beatles music that my dad and mom played stood out to me when I was little, from the wonder and imagination of Yellow Submarine to the thrill of being swung around every birthday by my dad while he played their song Birthday. I find their music so inspiring and hopeful, and I am trying to be the same, so the Beatles really connect with me. A few years ago, I spelled to my dad that I wanted to see Paul McCartney in concert more than anyone else. We've listened to SiriusXM, the Beatles channel, constantly since. I became a diehard Beatles fan, and this fall I was so lucky to finally see Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr in concert.
Wow, and seeing that concert with Aiden must have been just an incredible moment as a parent.
Oh, absolutely astounding. I mean, I'm a music reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I have a very privileged job. I feel very lucky to get to do what I get to do. Music means so much to so many people, and I hear that all the time from readers. And it's a great privilege to be able to cover concerts. And I've seen a lot of really very special concerts. I've been very lucky. Be able to do this, though, with Aiden and Ava and Mia and Christy, to see Ringo Starr with Aiden and see Paul McCartney. We were able to see him twice this fall, actually. it just meant so much because it's something that he's wanted to do for years, especially to see them. We really, really got to understand, because he communicates through letterboard, how much the Beatles mean to him and how much this meant to him. And to be able to know that, like, that feels like a miracle, because there was a time there for years where Aidan didn't know, we didn't know, you know, if he could communicate, if he could express things like, I love Paul McCartney, I love the Beatles, and this is why, which is what he's doing now constantly. And so to be able to learn that from him, because of being able to master his communication through the letterboard, and then be able to give him those experiences that he always wanted and was finally able to express, it just was deeply meaningful for all of us.
Of course, I had to ask Aidan about his favorite Beatles song, and he leveled with me about, you know, picking just one. Let's take a listen.
I am asked that a lot. It's impossible for me to pick just one. On the first episode of We Want to Tell You, I picked 8 songs that made me a huge fan. They included Now and Then, the first new Beatles song released in my lifetime, and Get Back, which I associate with Peter Jackson's Get Back documentary, which deepened my appreciation of the Beatles. We started the episode with All You Need Is Love, which is such perfect songwriting, with a simple but powerful message.
What is your greatest hope for Aidan?
I just want him to be happy and to live the life that he wants to live. It's what I want for Ava and Mia as well. You know, for him to be able to communicate and have this radio show, you know, he's just so, we're all just so thrilled for him. And he's so thrilled for that as well, you know, because not only is he doing something that he just like loves, he like loves the Beatles and able to share that with the Beatles. He's very passionate about trying to really raise awareness around people like him, non-speakers with autism and apraxia. Aidan has faced a lot of assumptions. I think, you know, if he's a non-speaker, people might assume he's not smart. And there's been, you know, cases of he's expressed frustrations and we've about people like, you know, maybe talk to him like kind of almost like a sing-song voice, like almost like he's a toddler. And there's just things like that that are very frustrating. And to be able to kind of express who he is, what he feels, what he shares, and to raise awareness around people like himself, around non-speakers with autism. They have so much to give to the world, and they're incredibly smart, incredibly funny, and love things like the Beatles, like everyone else. And that just means the world. And that's his dream. That's what he wants to do with his life. And I'm just so proud of him that at 14, that dream is coming true. And he is such a determined person. He's going to keep on going and keep on doing this and keep, you know, raising this awareness and bringing good to the world around this cause.
To end this interview, I asked Aidan to take us out on some, you know, Beatles trivia and tap that deep knowledge. And so I think now it's time where we get schooled. So let's listen to the trivia that Aidan is sharing with us.
Here are a few. She's Leaving Home was the first Beatles song to feature a female musician, harpist Sheila Bromberg. It took 55 hours of studio time for the Beatles to make a single song, Strawberry Fields Forever. Martha, My Dear is about Paul McCartney's dog. And Here Comes the Sun is the great closing song for the Milwaukee Public Museum's Wisconsin Stargazing Planetarium program. Go check it out. Kate, thank you so much for having me.
Aidan, thank you so much. And Piet, thank you for sharing this journey with your son and your family. It's been an honor to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That is 14-year-old Aidan Levy, the youngest ever host on the SiriusXM The Beatles channel, and his father, Piet Levy, music reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Episodes of Aidan's radio show drop monthly, and the show is called We Want to Tell You. Wisconsin Today daily newsletter is out each morning, and each weekday our colleague in the newsroom, newsletter editor Jenny Peek, is curating for you the day's top stories from around the state. Incredible audio segments to check out, feature photos from WPR's photojournalist Angela Major,
And you'll find behind-the-scenes conversations with reporters and producers about their work and who they are as people and delivering trustworthy news. And there are also opportunities for you to provide feedback and weigh in on polls. You can sign up at WPR.org/newsletters. Stay informed and connected. That's the Wisconsin Today daily newsletter to your inbox. Subscribe at WPR.org/newsletters. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.